Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm your host, Ryan Shelton, and today we're joined by Edward A. David, author of A Christian Approach to Corporate Religious Liberty, just published in 2020 by Palgrave Macmillan. Edward, thanks so much for being here. It's great to have you.
Ryan, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations on the wonderful new book, A Christian Approach to Corporate Religious Liberty. I'm very excited to talk to you about it, but before we get into the book, would you mind sharing with us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm a postdoctoral research fellow in the Faculty of Theology and Religion at Oxford. I'm specifically part of an institution called the Oxford Character Project. And our remit is really the study of character and the study of responsible leadership within corporate settings. I'm very much looking forward to diving into this work. I'm a new postdoctoral research fellow here at Oxford. But prior to that, I was at the University of Oxford as a DPhil student or a PhD student working on law and religion issues. And I wrote a thesis on corporate religious liberty, which then turned into this book with Palgrave Macmillan. So I'm currently working on character with the Oxford Character Project, but I'm also on the side, if you will, working still in the field of law and religion. And I find it this crossover between both character and virtue and religious freedom or law and religion to be a really rich area of investigation.
That's absolutely right, Edward. That is one of the things that makes your book so interesting, such a unique approach. So let's get into it. Why don't we? In a nutshell, yeah. you are seeking to challenge some of the terms of the debate around corporate religious liberty. We'll get into some of the terrain of the debate in just a moment. But in summary, what is your proposal? What are you hoping to contribute in the overall argument of your book?
Yeah, I think maybe to discuss the main points of this book, it might help to draw our attention to, I think, a really useful political cartoon that came out in the wake of Burwell versus Hobby Lobby Stores Incorporated, which was the 2014 U.S. Supreme Court case that dealt with the religious freedom claims of a closely held for-profit corporation and that corporation's objection to supplying certain contraceptive services and contraceptive devices, et cetera, to employees, right? There's a religious objection to this. So let me just draw attention to the cartoon and then I can get to the main points, my main proposal of the book. So in this political cartoon, it depicts two people conversing kind of in a corporate penthouse. And the first person, who's presumably an employee, asks with a bit of indignation on his face, and he goes, "You don't pay minimum wage?" And then the other person across the desk responds pretty matter-of-factly and says, "It's against my religion." And this is a unsurprisingly stoic response from this latter person, who happens to have a skyscraper for his head. And now sitting on the desk here is a sign, it's like a nameplate that says, corporations are people too. And so what this political cartoon is conveying, it's getting to that that idea that causes so much friction in public discourse around what is the moral status of corporations? Are they like human persons that deserve moral respect, moral rights, and then translated to legal rights to religious freedom? Now, my book takes issue with kind of basing our conversations around the ethics of corporate religious freedom on the metaphor of corporate moral personhood or corporate personality. And I find that these metaphors can be really distracting. So instead of asking, you know, is a corporation a moral person that deserves moral rights and legal rights by extension, I'm proposing something different, and I'm proposing something from the Christian ethical tradition that holds out groups to not be moral persons, but holds out groups as coordinated actions. And when we understand a group like a for-profit corporation through the lens of ethical reasoning, through moral philosophy, as a verb, essentially, as coordinated action, we can then start to get to the ethical conversation with a bit more clarity. We can talk about the consequences of that corporate action. We can talk about the players in the corporate action. We can get a lot more granularity into our moral discourse that is at bottom more useful than kind of invocations of corporate moral personhood.
It's very helpful. You're entering into a conversation that, of course, has been going on for a little while. You know, I'm wondering, as we start to hear how your proposal is entering this ongoing dialogue, who are some of the major voices that you're interacting with, and what are some of the major landmarks that have to be considered as you map out the terrain of this conversation?
Yeah, that's a good question. In a nutshell, there are so many kind of strains to this conversation, right? We can talk about so many ideas in political theory, in political theology. We can talk about what groups are. We can talk about the nature of individual rights, group rights. We can talk about what churches are. We can get into whole discussions around ecclesiology. We can get into the nitty-gritty in so many fields. And that's why this area around corporate religious freedom is so interesting, because theology, philosophy, law, social ontology, sociology, psychology, all play a role in here. Now, that said, what I find useful is to approach, to draw together all of these disciplines, these disciplinary discussions that could feed into an analysis of corporate religious liberty. I like to think of them through the lens of group ontology, which in a nutshell is the study of what groups are. And I think there's two schools of thought around the use of group ontology with respect to corporate religious freedom that are useful to identify. So here's the first kind of trajectory or school of thought in this group ontology religious freedom discussion. And that's the view of reductionism. Now, reductionism basically wants to move from an idea of a strongly metaphysical person that is traditionally understood to the church, the medieval corpus mysticum, moving from that idea, and then throughout history, then going to, say, John Locke's true church, and I say that in quotes, true church, citing his letter concerning toleration. And that true church for Locke is now a voluntary society of men, and no longer thought of as the corpus mysticum of medieval ages, where the Eucharist and the actions of the Holy Spirit or of Christ working in the church really kind of created an agent of sorts, like a corporate person. So with John Locke's church, we are moving to that voluntary association of men with really no discussion of group ontology or a discussion of a strongly metaphysical being that members become incorporated into. So we're moving throughout history from a strong group metaphysics to potentially no metaphysics with John Locke around the group. And then we get to today's political liberals or liberal egalitarians, amongst whom we might consider Cecil Laborde at Oxford University, also legal theorists like Richard Schrager and Micah Schwartzman, who are both very bright scholars at the University of Virginia in the United States, who have also engaged in the corporate religious liberty debate. And when we get to these political liberals, not only is the strong group metaphysics dropped, but it's actually in a certain sense reviled. I almost hesitate in using that term because it's so strong, and I don't want to paint them as these theorists as completely inimical to some theological ideas, right? However, these political liberal theorists do claim that actually group ontology is really morally distracting, because when we deal with that what is a group question, they say that, hey, no matter how you cut this, no matter how you define what is a group, at the end of the day, it's going to be our moral or political philosophy that drives the conversation anyway. Yeah. So I see this trend of reductionism moving from the strong group realism or strong group metaphysics of the corpus mysticum to today's political liberals. And the political liberal position really endorsing this reductionism and saying, let's leave behind the strong group metaphysics because it's morally distracting. In fact, let's leave behind group ontology because it's morally distracting. And let's just get to the political, philosophical, political moral discussion. Now, I have some thoughts on that in a second, but let me identify the second kind of strand of group ontology that I point towards in my book. And that second sort of handling of group ontology, we might call ecclesialism. And ecclesialism basically takes the position that the moral protections or the moral rights that we then translate into legal rights that we give to the church, we should expand those rights to for-profit corporations that are ostensibly religious, maybe operated with religious motivation, but actually can be identifiably secular in their activity, right? So the selling of arts and crafts as a secular activity, not a distinctively religious activity. Now, ecclesialism says, hey, let's not narrowly define the church and the church's protections and restrict those to, say, your traditional hierarchical religious institution, like the Catholic Church, for example. And it's saying, let's kind of lower that ecclesiology and let's spread it out horizontally to other types of institutions that we normally might not claim to be churches, like for-profit firms, for example. Now, the religion scholar who's worked extensively in the religious freedom debates, Winifred Fowler Sullivan, actually wrote a book also in 2020. I think it's called Church State Corporation. And it actually came out after I had the book kind of accepted and published. And I went, oh no, this is just such a fantastic book to engage with.
Yeah.
And so she also identifies this kind of ecclesialism, this extension of the idea of the church and like a strong group metaphysics to non-church entities, like for-profit firms. And so she doesn't use the term ecclesialism, I do, but she identifies this trend of low church ecclesiology. Again, this trend to understand, say, for-profit firms as actually types of churches, and therefore as the types of institutions that should receive relatively robust legal protections. Now, Sullivan, just to be very clear, is not making a moral case that ecclesialism or low church ecclesiology should be widely adopted. She is certainly not saying that. And I have my criticisms of it as well. Now, so I've pointed to reductionism, which wants to kind of get rid of group ontology. And then I've also pointed to ecclesialism, which kind of still trades on the ideas of the currency of group ontology, but might want to expand a strong group metaphysics to other types of entities. And so you can see how these two trajectories can be used on almost polar opposite ends of a moral debate on corporate religious freedom. On one end, religious freedom for corporate entities or organized groups should really be restricted to voluntary associations. John Locke's true church, the political liberal's ideal type of institution that should receive moral or legal recognition for religious freedom, strong religious freedom claims. And then on the other side, if you accept ecclesialism and the kind of strong group metaphysics that's implied with it, you get those who might claim that not only should churches receive strong, robust corporate religious freedoms, but potentially for-profit firms like Hobby Lobby or, say, Asher's Bakery in Northern Ireland, where you are, should receive also potentially equally robust moral and legal recognition, legal protections in this corporate religious liberty debate. So again, kind of opposite sides of a moral debate. I find that actually we need a middle way. We need a middle way in this debate, which has become extremely polarized.
Now, before we get to your middle way, you also in the book start to give us some sense of how has, within the Christian tradition, corporate religious liberty been understood, both in respect to the church itself and organizations who are religiously affiliated, but maybe outside the church. So could you talk a little bit about you mentioned the Catholic and Protestant tradition's approach to these questions?
Yeah. So what I found in my, you know, my desire to find a middle way, right? This desire to get past the corporate personhood metaphor, the desire to kind of combat some of the extremes of the moral conclusions in reductionism and ecclesialism. I said to myself, all right, first and foremost, let's check what the churches themselves have to say about religious freedom in general, but then also around corporate religious freedom. And just to be clear, when I say corporate, I typically mean organized group. So any sort of organized group, so a wide or broad understanding of corporate. So I don't just mean for-profit corporation. So I wanted to know, what have the churches said about religious freedom and corporate religious freedom? In a nutshell, what I did is I examined modern ecclesial statements. So basically leading up to and around the mid 20th century, you know, around the formation proclamation of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a kind of landmark treatise on religious freedom, in part, that was established after the Second World War. And I wanted to understand what the churches, both especially Catholic and Protestant, widely ecumenical Protestants, including Orthodox churches, understood on these issues. In a nutshell, what I found is corporate religious freedom was really well defined with respect to churches. So with respect to religious institutions as we might traditionally understand them, as, you know, congregations, as institutions that teach, preach a doctrine, that educate the young in this doctrine, that evangelize, and that engage in worship, right? And it's to be expected that there would be a really rich and well-developed understanding of the rights of churches, the rights of religious institutions, given the long history of the development of the church's identity from, you know, ancient Rome, and of course, prior, right, with the people Israel. So really taking this corporate understanding of who the church is throughout time, throughout the Middle Ages into the early modern period and today, again, really well-defined understandings of there are specific activities, again, around selection of ministers, teaching and preaching, worship, that states really should not be in the business of interfering with. These are kind of sacrosanct areas of life for religious communities, for churches, that the state, at least in the kind of mid-20th century and moving onwards, the notion was, get out of state, please get out of the business of this. And actually churches too, get out of the business of really strong arming states as well. Because what we find, especially in the World Council of Churches documents around religious freedom, is a real concern that actually Roman Catholic countries, prior to the proclamation of the UN Declaration for Human Rights, were being singled out, or well, rather, were being called out by the World Council of Churches and pointing to the fact that actually there were Protestant communities that didn't have kind of rights to public worship in these predominantly Catholic countries where the church indeed had political power in addition to the kind of strong presence of the church in those societies. So anyway, long story short, the churches have a really rich, robust, well-developed understanding of church freedoms, and you can see this in these modern ecclesial statements on religious freedom. But what I found is the churches didn't have very well-articulated understandings of religious freedom in other group contexts. So in the context of for-profit corporations, in the context of closely held family firms, all of these things, right? And that may be to be expected, right? The kind of rights of business, if you will, with respect to religious freedoms weren't really of such high concern prior to the middle of the 20th century in many nations and many societies. In large part, I speculate, because you potentially did not have such a large administrative state that was promising so many things and reaching so intimately or so closely into areas of life, say around reproductive choice, around sex and the family. So we didn't have these large administrative states operating with such close proximity to really hot button or intimate issues as we do now, for example, say in the United States, or even here in the UK. So the upshot of this is an undeveloped understanding of for-profit corporate religious freedom. And what I saw in the modern ecclesial text was maybe a thing or two said about responsibility to wield one's religious freedom claim such that anti-discrimination laws weren't violated, or maybe some notions that, yes, religious freedom extends to individuals and their communities, right? And this was about the extent to which I noticed any kind of explicit things being said about corporate religious freedom for-profit firms from official church documents. Okay, now, that said, when Hobby Lobby and the Affordable Care Act that led up to Hobby Lobby, and just to remind some of your viewers, if they're not familiar, the Affordable Care Act that President Obama kind of signed into law had a contraceptive mandate. And the contraceptive mandate required employers, basically across the board, to pay for the contraceptive services that were approved by the Federal Drug Administration. And some of these contraceptives were also believed to be abortifacients. So as you might imagine, many employers, of course, I should note that religious institutions, churches, synagogues, mosques, etc., were exempt from this contraceptive mandate in the first instance. But other employers, you can imagine some that had kind of traditional religious objections to either abortifacients or contraceptives or both, you know, caused some difficulties, to put it mildly, for the Obama administration on this point. And what we see during this controversial sort of time are religious leaders banding together and kind of writing an open letter to the Obama administration. And in one open letter that I examine in the book, these religious leaders define religious institutions as, in a nutshell, as virtually any sort of institution that might be created and run with a religious motivation or intention. Now, as you can imagine, that's a very wide definition of religious institution. It moves beyond, say, the corpus mysticum, like the locus for Roman Catholics, at least as I interpret in the book, of where the Eucharist happens. And the Eucharist is the source and summit, as Pope John Paul II said, of at least the Roman Catholic Communion. It expands that notion of religious institution into for-profit firms, potentially. So Winifred Fowler Sullivan's notion of low ecclesiology is actually happening in this open letter written by an ecumenical mix of religious leaders, whereby they use the term religious institution in a very wide sense. And for me, this is problematic, actually. So while I'm in the book, I'm very sympathetic to extending religious freedoms, at least in the first instance, as a consideration to for-profit firms. I resist the attempt to do that by defining for-profit firms as if they are religious institutions. And why do I resist this? Because religious institutions and the legal rights and the kind of moral logic or sense that we put behind those legal rights, that moral logic, in my mind, should really be applied to churches in a kind of central case. Because once we start saying, as Christian communities, once we start saying, well, no, the street, the bakery down the street should also be treated like a church, then I think it makes Christians look pretty unreasonable, actually. And it kind of, I think it just pours gasoline on the kind of culture wars when we try to claim that the for-profit firm down the street should receive robust protections as if it were a religious institution. So to answer your question, Ryan, you know, I saw a hole, or I see a hole, in the church's official statements on corporate religious freedom, to the point where it can just get a bit messy, and like the descriptive categories blend into these really loose moral categories, which then upsets, I think, and again adds gasoline to the fire of the moral discourse around religious freedom, and it just makes the churches look unreasonable. So part of my task in the book is to articulate some relatively clear principles, I hope, on the logic and limits of corporate religious freedom and the limits of church freedoms and the scope of for-profit freedoms.
Yeah, that's incredibly helpful, Edward. And so you've charted how in the modern ecclesial statements, there's some category confusion, or at least some unhelpful precedents that might be coming out here. And even though that's true of these modern ecclesial statements from the 20th century, part of the solution you found is actually a retrieval. So you find that Thomas Aquinas can actually help to sharpen some of the categories about how we think about groups ontologically as verbs. So can you talk about how Aquinas becomes a helpful category, or a helpful articulator of some better categories, and how this contributes to your positive proposal in the book?
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I love talking about Thomas Aquinas. Like Flannery O'Connor, I tend to find that having the Summa beside one's on one's bedstand is a good thing, right beside the Bible, and kind of dipping into this this wisdom is a faith and reason, if you will, is quite edifying. So that said, Aquinas, in retrieving some of his insight on this, which also he's retrieving insight from Aristotle, helps us get to a middle way. Yeah. Helps us get to a middle way between the reductionism and between a kind of potentially irresponsible ecclesialism. So here's what Aquinas has to say on groups. So following Aristotle's description of the polis, Aquinas understands organized groups as a composition of parts. So whereas Plato in his Republic almost gets to this point where there's too much sharing amongst the citizens of a state, to the point where we might think of that state as like this weird whole, right? Where children's parents are basically where parents don't know who their children are, et cetera, right? Some people point to like a communism in Plato. Aristotle says, no, okay. This is all really confusing, actually. The state, the polis, is a composition of different parts. We have different citizens within this polis. They all have different roles to play. So let's look at the polis in terms of individuals and the roles that they play towards the end of the state, which is involved in the flourishing of each individual and the flourishing of the state as a whole, as a group of individuals. Aquinas picks up on this Aristotelian notion of the polis as a composition of parts. And viewing this composition of parts specifically from the order of moral philosophy. And the order of moral philosophy takes as its subject matter the actions that are self-constituting of the person. So voluntary actions that are self-constituting. Viewing groups as a composition of parts, and viewing them from the discipline of moral philosophy, then, this invites us to view groups as coordinated activity, as a composition of not just parts, but a composition of activities. And who acts? Well, it's the individual who acts. And individuals have the capacity to intend together, to pursue common ends together, to jointly act so as to bring those ends about. So Aquinas, again, drawing upon Aristotle's methodology here, views groups as a composition of, or a coordination of, individual actions. Now, this is really helpful, especially when we're talking about the morality of corporate religious freedom, right? This is really helpful because already Aquinas has moved us from an ontology, a metaphysics, but he's moved us in an organic way to moral philosophy. So we're looking at the same phenomenon. So it's a phenomenon of individuals who are acting together, right? So from a metaphysical or an ontological perspective, we see the individuals themselves acting, right? That's the subject matter. But we can look at that same phenomenon from the lens of moral philosophy, and we can see that these individuals acting together are actually engaging in ethically analyzable action, right? And their coordinated actions together, we view that as essentially what is a group, you know, what the group is doing, a group action. So that it's like two sides of a coin, this ontological perspective and this moral perspective. So when we take Aquinas's coordination of action perspective of groups, we can do an ethical analysis of what's happening in the group. So for example, we can point to the internal public policy of that group. The internal public policy may be the sort of social norms in the group. It may point to the constitution, like written documents of the group that dictate behavior expectations. Think of like an employment contract or something like that. We can look to this internal public policy, which helps coordinate the individual's actions. We can also look at the ruler, as Aquinas says, or the authority, or the leaders within the group, who have like a special place in the group's life to help coordinate all those people. So think of the boss that puts together the employment contracts, that helps steer the ethos, the corporate culture, if you will, of that group. We can look at, so the leader, we can look at the public policy, and we can say to ourselves, okay, are these means of coordination, are they ethical? You know, is this a good employment contract? Does it elicit the right sorts of behavior, ethical behavior that we want out of individuals? Is the leader herself acting ethically? Is she being an exemplar of moral behavior and helping others kind of live out the ideals of the corporate culture? We can then also look at the individuals themselves, the employees, and go, is that, you know, employee X behaving and advancing the corporate aim? So what happens when we view groups as a composition of parts, or when we view it specifically from the lens of moral philosophy, we can start to get to the granularities of what a group is. And we can start to think about, you know, these individuals are doing ABC to promote group end X, and maybe person B is doing it in a bad way. That is actually causing some trouble for the rest of the people in the corporation, or maybe that action may be having third-party effects, right? So harming other people outside of the corporation. So this is what Aquinas's ontology of groups allows us to do. It allows us to think with granularity on the moral issues, on what's actually happening on a kind of firm-wide level in the organized group.
That's great. It's easy to see, Edward, how this starts to to sharpen a, what was a really blunt tool, and now there's so much more precision in how we're able to start analyzing group behavior outside of just simply institutional churches. So as we start to wrap up our conversation here, can you start to tease out some of the take-home applications here as you apply this to how we think about corporate religious liberty? And then maybe just a word about who this book is for and who might find your argument to be particularly helpful.
Yeah. So actually one potential case study that could be very useful, and this is a recent case study for us, is there was controversy recently in the Roman Catholic Brooklyn Diocese around COVID-19 restrictions. And so in a nutshell, what was happening was New York State or New York City was basically saying, all right, churches in kind of high COVID-19 red zones where there's lots of cases can only have 10 people inside of those churches. Now, the Diocese of Brooklyn, and actually there was Orthodox Jewish community too that sued against the city, they said, look, we're in the red zone. You're only letting 10 people inside. However, you're letting potentially hundreds of people go into the Walmart next door and shop, even in this red zone. So you're putting no caps on these businesses, but you're putting caps on what we're doing. Now, where the idea of Aquinas' group ontology, where this comes in and helps us kind of examine the ethics of restrictions on churches or businesses, again, deals with a close examination of what a group is or what sort of actions are happening in that group. So here's a potential proposal. In a church, what the church community is doing, what these coordinating members are doing, they are coming together, they're entering that church building, they are picking up hymnals potentially, and they're singing and they're worshiping God, and they're staying in one place, kind of standing, and being there for about an hour's time or so, right, for a service or a mass or whatever it might be. And we can look at that sort of corporate or organized group activity and identify it and describe it in a particular way. 10 to 100 individuals coming together, standing, singing, potentially creating conditions where COVID can spread widely. But then look at your retail store next door where individuals are coming inside and out, potentially with mask on, or hopefully with mask on in these red zones, potentially not speaking to each other and coming inside and out very quickly. So if we were to think about what's collectively happening, if you will, in this retail environment, these are two different types of actions going on. These are two different types of group actions. And we can start to make distinctions here and go, okay, wait a second. Actually, this sort of group action in the church might actually create conditions that are COVID problematic and thus kind of morally problematic in relation, especially in comparison to that for-profit retail activity going on where individuals are potentially not talking and coming in and out relatively quickly. And this is a distinction that Justice Sotomayor made in her kind of dissent in a case that did end up protecting the Brooklyn Diocese and the Orthodox Jewish community. Now, in the end, to put my flag up, I agree ultimately with how the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Brooklyn Diocese, because I think there's other issues to consider. But what Sotomayor brings up is actually a really good, I think, case study for how a more granular perspective of what groups are and what they're doing can actually help inform the moral discussion, right? So I'm so glad she made that point of actually these are two different types of group actions, and this should be considered in our moral calculus, if you will, of what's going on and whether rights should be extended to these types of entities.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And it's easy to start to see all of the generative possibilities that are opened up as we start to think through the particularities that you've given us some new tools to attend to. Well, Edward, you've been so generous with your time with us today. We could talk so much more about continuing to unpack the implications of your book here, but if anyone has had their interest piqued, where can they go to find out more? And then maybe what can we be looking forward to coming out from you in the future?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks so much, Ryan, for having me on your show. And I just want to touch back to your second question from before, which was, you know, who's the audience for this book? And I'd say there's at least two audiences. One would be Christian communities, right? Christian communities that are struggling with a large administrative state that may be impinging upon their corporate activities, their organized group activities. So whether these are churches or whether these are individuals who have theological religious motivations in the workplace. And what I hope is that my book can offer a resource mod of sorts, you know, a retrieval of a Christian ethical and a group ontological heritage to start to think clearly about, you know, what is this group that I want protected and what might be the just limits of the protections that I'm trying to seek. Mm-hmm. And a second audience would be a kind of broad law and religion group of scholars. So those who are very much interested in the interactions of law and theology. And, you know, group ontology, I'd say against, you know, the statements of scholars that I tremendously respect, Richard Traeger, Michael Schwartzman, Cecil Laborde, you know, pace their contentions that group ontology is actually super morally distracting. I'd say, on the contrary, we have in the Christian tradition a group ontology from Aquinas and from Aristotle that is actually quite morally useful and morally clarifying. So all that said, I hope these audiences find a lot of insight and richness from the book. They can find out more on my website, which is edwardadavid.com. I'm also on Twitter at Edward in Oxford. And I'm always updating with new essays, articles, and whatnot that come out in the field of law and religion. So I'd really encourage your listeners to follow me there and to keep up.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Edward, for taking the time to come and talk with us about your wonderful new book, A Christian Approach to Corporate Religious Liberty, available now from Palgrave Macmillan. Edward, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to this episode of the New Books Network. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd encourage you to like and rate and subscribe and do all of those things. But as always, most importantly, if there's anyone that you think of as you were listening to this episode, you might find the conversation that we've had here today particularly interesting, I invite you to share it with them. That's the best way to spread the word about what we're trying to do here at the New Books Network. That's it for now, and I hope you have a great day.